This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We had Dr. Indra Frank on the other day talking about three of the measures that the General Assembly is taking up here involving the environment. And we have more to talk about that the Hoosier Environmental Council is closely watching. We have the Senior Policy Director for the HEC, Tim Maloney, with us from his office in Indianapolis. Tim, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Chris, glad to do it.
Well, let's get in first here, I guess, of the two major bills that are certainly of note here in the region. One is definitely about the environment. In fact, two of them actually about Lake Michigan. And you can go into more detail about how both the bills and the fact that they seem to be competing for each other's attention and everybody's attention. And then the other one's involving not only the environment, but also business as well. Let's talk first about the measures that are out there that the lawmakers are considering this session that are dealing with Lake Michigan.
Sure, Chris. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners know of the landmark Indiana Supreme Court decision in 2018, Gunderson v. State, which was brought by some landowners along the lake who were claiming that their property went to the water line. And so that was creating a conflict with people, the public's access to the shoreline in Lake Michigan. And the court ruled firmly that that the state of Indiana has owned the Lake Michigan shoreline up to the ordinary high water mark since the time of statehood, and that the state holds that land in public trust for use by the people of Indiana. And so it was a landmark ruling in favor of the public trust doctrine, and something that the folks up at Save the Dunes Council were part of that legal case. And now these bills in the General Assembly are follow-up bills to that. And they are competing, like you say. There's House Bill 1031, which is pending on the floor of the House of Representatives. And that's a bill promoted by the landowners who were on the losing end of the Gunderson case. While that bill has been watered down some from its original version, it still, to us, has a lot of problems. And instead, we prefer the Senate version, Senate Bill 325, which is sponsored or authored by Senator Sue Glick and Senator Karen Talion from the Northwest Indiana region. And that legislation would essentially codify the Gunderson decision in terms of the public trust lands along the shoreline. And then also following up the court case, it gives the Indiana DNR some rulemaking authority to address the scope of recreational activities that will occur on that public beach land, and that's something actually the Supreme Court basically referred back to the legislature. They upheld the traditional uses like walking and fishing and swimming, and for other uses, and whether there would be any limitations on them, that would be done through the DNR's rulemaking. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good bill. It came out of strongly out of Senate committee, and it's also pending floor action, and that is the bill that we'd like to see pass, and all the groups that are in favor of what the Gunderson decision found, from environmental groups to the tourism groups and a number of the landowners and property owners there in the Lake Michigan area, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. There's a broad base of groups and organizations that are supporting that. So that's something we'll be, working down here in Indianapolis to help get that passed.
I was going to ask you about this, about House Bill 1031, about this, even though it's been amended, and I guess some of the language has been changed, taken out, and some other changes have been made. Is there anything in the amended version that that the Hoosier Environmental Council is interested in or is supporting? Obviously, you're putting more support to Senate Bill 325, and in fact, we put that as more as the preferred legislative route, following up on the Gunderson ruling.
Yeah. No, there's really nothing that's needed in the House bill, and it still has some provisions that a lot of folks find objectionable. One of those is that it would preempt local authority over seawalls and beach construction and give it exclusively to the DNR, and currently both local government and DNR have jurisdiction. I know a lot of the communities up there want to maintain their role in that as well. And then there's another provision that provides that the private landowners, besides maintaining and cleaning up their own part of the beach that they actually own above the ordinary high water mark, it allows them to also maintain and repair nearby beaches. So that means the landowners are getting permission to go work on the public beach lands, and that's just not appropriate. So those are still two provisions that remain in the bill that we find very problematic. Mm-hmm. And recently, bill would have actually required the state of Indiana to relinquish its claim to any land, any of this contested land, that at least to the landowners, where they had a deed that said their land went to the water line. That would just require the state to relinquish that property. And thankfully, the Judiciary Committee deleted that language. But again, there's still remaining problems with 1031, and we have the appropriate vehicle in the Senate, so there's just no need for 1031 to move forward.
Tim, I have a question, and it is related, I guess, in a way to both bills, but in particular as to whichever bill is the preferred one that's going to come out and finally come up for a vote. And it's the concern that has been recent about the erosion problem. It's on Lake Michigan, and we know that some of the beaches and communities in particular, like Portage, Ogden Dunes, Long Beach, and other places up there on Lake Michigan, they've had to close up entirely because of the erosion problem they're dealing with up there. Is there a possibility that if any of these, certainly Senate Bill 325, if it makes it through, is there a possibility that there might be some help for the communities to be able to deal with the erosion issue?
Well, Chris, so far that has not been discussed in mm-hmm. connection with these shoreline bills. And you may recall that in the last General Assembly, there was an effort to secure an appropriation for state matching money for a study, an Army Corps of Engineers study that would hopefully provide some recommended solutions for the erosion problem. That money came out of the budget at the last minute, and even though the General Assembly has just adopted some budgetary changes in a somewhat unusual action for an off-budget year, where they could have added that funding back in, and it didn't happen. And I know some of your state legislators from that area were also seeking an emergency declaration.
Yes, they are. They have. Many of them have.
Yeah, so far the state of Indiana has not, as I understand, has not done that, which is really a tragic thing. If that problem in that region, merit state attention for mm-hmm. sure, and it's unfortunate that state's just not taking any action right yeah. now.
Well, Tim, let's take up the second bill that you, the Hoosier Environmental Council, and your colleagues have been keeping an eye on, moving through the General Assembly. It's a Senate Bill 369, and it's one that's going to have a big impact on our public transportation up here, in particular the South Shore Commuter Railroad. The measure is going to help allow for ways to get more support and expansion through some economic means, through what are called transportation development districts. Tell us more about this particular bill and how the Hoosier Environmental Council feels about it.
Yes. Senate Bill 369 is authored by Senator Alting from Lafayette, Senator Holdman from Northern Indiana, Senator Lannan from Anderson, Stoops from Bloomington, and Becker from Evansville. And this legislation would provide similar funding options for local governments to expand their transit systems, and it would be similar to what happened for Central Indiana about 5 years ago. The General Assembly adopted a similar measure that applied to Indianapolis and the surrounding counties, and what it does is allow local government to adopt a local option income tax that can be used and be dedicated to funding transit expansion, and that's both urban and rural transit. And that was adopted for Central Indiana. Now the goal is to make that option available for all the communities and counties around Indiana, where there is demand, serious demand to do this. And it doesn't mandate any local action. It's just a funding option that localities can take care of if they are otherwise struggling to pay for transit, which is very common. We know that a lot of the rural transit providers, these small operations that provide on-demand services to people, seniors or people who otherwise can't drive or for some reason need or just choose to ride transit, and it's essential for a lot of rural people to get to, medical services and shopping and groceries and all that kind of thing. And there, many of those rural providers are saying they are turning away people because they just don't have the resources to meet their demand. And then in our urban areas, they're expanding out, and under current law, any public transportation corporation that operates a bus system, and, Gary would be one example that they cannot expand beyond their set jurisdiction, which typically is the municipality, unless they have or they can't pay for that expansion beyond their boundaries unless they have an agreement with a neighboring community to pay for that service. They can only tax within their jurisdiction. So if a community has new employers that are just outside the city limits, or the local hospital moves out to the suburbs, or other business or educational institutions, and that then you have a mobility challenge for getting people back and forth and to services or to jobs or employers who are looking for workers and can't find them right close to where they are. And so that's a great need from an economic standpoint in communities all around Indiana. And this gives, someone like, say, the Lafayette bus system or Fort Wayne, mm-hmm. They can now, raise extra money to extend their service out into the county and even link up with the rural providers and have an integrated system. And same, you mentioned the South Shore earlier, and this would allow all the communities that are along or nearby those South Shore corridors to provide much more effective linkages through, from neighborhoods and city centers to the South Shore stations. And again, you're getting an integrated system that really improves mobility and access to jobs and access to services. And then, from our standpoint, it's better for the environment. It helps reduce vehicle pollution and saves energy. So you can, have several pages of bullet pointed benefits that are provided by transit. And so, you see support from business, from environmental groups, from disability advocates, senior advocates. It's just got such widespread benefits. Yeah, that's a good bill. We're supporting it, and it is pending in the Indiana Senate.
Well, Tim, thank you very much for spending time going over these the measures that the Hoosier Environmental Council has been watching very closely during the General Assembly session and seeing how they move on through. They've gotten out of committee with support, and we hope that we get to see these two Senate bills we've referred to here in our conversation in particular make it through. Thank you for spending time going through them today.
I'm glad to do it, Chris. Thanks.
You're certainly welcome. Tim Maloney is the Senior Policy Director for the Hoosier Environmental Council. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Each week, a group of insiders joins us to offer some perspective on some of the week's top stories. This week, sounding off on the economic impact of online sports betting in Indiana and some more positive signs for tech growth in the Hoosier State. On the panel this time is Roger Harvey. He's the principal for the Bose Public Affairs Group in Indianapolis, with Irina Golichilinen, who is the CEO of Copper Mountain Technologies, and with Steve Appel, who is the vice president of Gregory and Appel Insurance in Indianapolis. Here's the conversation.
A big week in the state of Indiana, the state of the state address. Governor Holcomb delivering that address earlier in the week. Roger, I'll start with you. He touched on a lot of things. There was an economic development announcement. Teacher pay was in there. Tobacco issues. Your takeaway from the speech.
Well, a couple things. I think probably the biggest thing is for years they've talked about tobacco and raising the age. And this year it appears everyone's spraining an ankle jumping on the on the train. And so, you know, that certainly will be a good thing in terms of from a health standpoint. The other thing is it's always great to be governor when revenue exceeds forecasts, right? Yep. And so that's a good problem to have, although that means lots of people are going to have ideas on how to spend that extra money. Yep. But I think the governor was very thoughtful in how he came out with a plan in terms of how to utilize that money, help with some infrastructure in key parts around the state, mm-hmm. which will help higher education and help those that will be attending those schools.
Yeah, certainly ways to spend the money. Education in Indiana, a big issue, and teacher pay, a big issue. And that was addressed in the speech as well.
Yes, that is very, very important. The more money we can pay teachers, the better teachers we have. We have the more talented people going mm-hmm. into teaching. Mm-hmm. That means better children, better educated mm-hmm. populace.
Yep.
Always a good thing.
Steve.
Clearly, the red movement the teachers have been doing has had some effect, I think, and mm-hmm. it's getting addressed. It's still not fully worked out, it appears, but yeah. I'm sure something's going to happen. And at least the pensions are getting funded as well, which
yep.
is good.
Roger mentioned the state revenue situation. There was also an economic development announcement in the speech. Fiat Chrysler in Howard County, $400 million, essentially a retooling and expansion will mean some new workers, a combination as well. So it seems as though the Indiana economy, including the manufacturing sector, heading into 2020, looks pretty positive.
Very exciting to see that. And there's As an employer, I will tell you, hiring is hard because there's lots of good jobs, and anybody who's any good has a job right now.
Yeah, we're going to get to you on the tech thing in a minute, too, Irina. But, Steve, as you saw that big announcement in Chrysler, posit because their manufacturing jobs tend to pay a little bit above or sometimes a lot above the average wage.
Yeah, well, it's good to see Indiana maintaining its competitive automotive stance in the country. But also it's nice to see for as a taxpayer is when those incentives aren't paid out until they've actually hired mm-hmm. the people. So I think I'd like to see that being done as well.
And I would just add, I think sometimes people forget when you look at Indiana's economy and the history of it, we have been very successful in manufacturing for a number of years.
Long
and
time.
So
yeah.
when you see this additional investment in the automotive area, and then when you look at the other assets we have in automotive mm-hmm. investments, whether it's Toyota down in Princeton or Honda in Greensburg and so forth, Subaru, and Lafayette, it continues to build on that momentum because we are a leader in manufacturing, and that's something I know our leaders in the state have embraced for a number of years.
Yeah, that's a good point. Next generation manufacturing, to be sure. Technology investment, certainly the tech ecosystem, if you will, in Indiana has experienced a lot of momentum. A couple of stories this week. Tech investment saw a triple-digit increase in Indiana last year. Also, Indiana among the top 10 markets for future tech growth, that according to a survey out from Zillow.
It's exciting to see the recognition of all the hard work that the tech community has done over the years. back to the 1990s and the software artistry start. One of the first software companies here that is the granddaddy of it all, mm-hmm. and a lot of the community work. It's been very exciting to see the growth.
And that's because we do a lot of these stories, you know, startups launching and a lot of very positive stories. Some people say, is it really as positive as some of the news is? I mean, there seems to be a lot of momentum. You're in the midst of it. You see it every day. What's your take on the tech economy in Indiana?
It's thriving. Even being downtown where my office is, you just see the people in there and there's excitement, there's energy in the air. The acquisitions, on the one hand, you look at this and you say, oh, there's another company that got acquired by out of state. But what happens, these people take their money, they go build new businesses. So it's a great thing for the state.
I saw that the number was 350 plus million this year, and at a recent VC luncheon, they said that 500 million is kind of the next target for Indiana to try and get to, which I wouldn't be surprised if we maybe hit it next year or the year after. So it's good.
A big part of that is, you know, getting VC money, not just from Indiana, but from other parts, from the coast and other places around the country. It's always been a challenge for Indiana. There was a study that came out from Notre Dame this week that I thought was interesting, talking about air travel and connectivity between cities and tech communities, really cutting down on that local investor bias and opening up the gateways for more investment. And Irene, I know you've got an opinion on that. We see how Indianapolis had very few nonstop flights years ago. Now I think we have over 50.
Yes. Direct flight to San Francisco is one of the reasons that we have the increased VC investment. The venture capitalists look at places where they have more than one investment, so they can do one trip and cover multiple companies. Mm-hmm. And if they can do it in a day, that's even better. So from that perspective, these things are key. And Boston is another investment hub. So I think achieving $500 million just got a little easier.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, the coast, I mean, you look at the large population centers, you know, the majority of those are going to be on both coasts. And with the people out there and the size of companies, that's where a lot of the financial resources are. And, you know, in the past, it's really taken a huge effort to get people just interested. And then you got to figure out how to get them here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the more direct flights we have, as we see more and more of these independent third-party groups ranking us, although I am questioning how Oklahoma City was number one in that.
On that list,
We'll find out if this is streamed in Oklahoma City. I'll get hate mail for that. But I like Oklahoma City, but I don't think they're number one. But in any event, the nonstop flights, direct flights, are really going to help us continue to build on that momentum and getting some of that VC money.
And we saw this week another nonstop added to Boston, again, an East Coast tech hub as well.
And the big life science activity in Boston as well, which will help our life science community here too, on the investment side.
In terms of dollars, big dollars coming into the state, sports betting was just legalized, actually launched in Indiana in early September through 4 months. I think the number is well over $400 million was wagered both in the sports books and also online. It seems as though it was a successful launch and one that, you know, sports betting's here to stay. And Indiana, one of the leaders, one of the innovators, one of the first few states in the gaming business.
Well, things like fantasy football have been leading this, and now the sports betting, and I think it's exciting, and it does merge technology with sports, and I think it actually does drive more interest, and especially the concern, though, it's so much fun that, you know, the Boca Raton Bowl starts looking interesting. Place a little halftime bet on, so hopefully people are watching there, keeping safe.
Yeah, I would add, to me, the biggest thing is how, and you referenced this, Gary, how we got out front early on this, and, you know, other states are going to figure this out, and so I think it's important to establish that beachhead early on, and hopefully that'll help us weather some of these other states that jump online. It's no different than what it was with the casino industry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as more and more casinos started popping up in other states, that impacted our income and revenue from gambling.
68% of the wagers were online. Mm-hmm. And the sports books, the casinos investing millions of dollars to create sports books in their physical structures around the state, too. So it's meant jobs as well around the state. That's all the time we have for another edition of The Insiders this week. Roger Harvey, Irina Goloshokin, and Steve Appel. Thank you, one and all.
You can hear more from The Insiders by going on to the Inside Indiana Business website at InsideIndianaBusinessOneWord.com. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Since the start of the new year, Gary has experienced 8 homicides. What can police or the community do to quell the violence? Michael Puente, the host of the Lakeshore Public Radio program Off Mic, recently spoke with Gary resident and activist Apostle East in our studio to get his take on the situation. And here's the conversation.
Apostle East, thank you for being here at Lakeshore Public Radio on Off Mic.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let me tell you a little bit what I know of Apostle East. I first met Apostle East when I produced a story a few years back because this man took it upon his shoulders to patrol his neighborhood called Marshalltown Terrace in Gary. It's when Gary's own police force wasn't doing any patrols. So that's when I met him. We went out on sort of a midnight run and seeing what he does. It was pretty intense. And I got to say, it's incredible work that he does. Apostle East, before we get into the conversation, tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Well, as a religious leader, I became a overseer, and that was different religious organizations would come up under my leadership, and we would do an internal audit to see why was the community not involved with the church. And so my thing at that point was to take the pulpit and take it to the community, so to speak, senior citizens and youth. And at that time, crying was rapid then. And my own mother, I picked her up from her home to go to Sunday school. Mm-hmm. And an older gentleman at the time had been a bus driver for years. And Mr. Jones was his name. And he had a little mini market serving mm-hmm. the community. And he was murdered there. And so when I picked her up, the yellow tape was around. At this time, the community was abandoned. And so one of my things back then, I've been from South St. Joseph County, Northwest Indiana region, the southern parts of town, Mississippi, mm-hmm. Tennessee, Arkansas, things of that nature, Chicago, Inglewood, and just to provide a safe haven. If I could, for the communities. And so Marshalltown Terrace at that time was abandoned. We took it and put it back into a safe haven, worked with law enforcement, worked with administration. At that time, the late Mayor Clay mm-hmm. was in office.
You know, Apostle Weiss, you know, we see a lot of stories in the press, in the Times, Post Tribune, and TV, this homicide, this person was gunned down. But we rarely get to see the people that impacts, not even, say, the family members, but the neighborhoods, the neighbors that have to sit there after the cameras are turned off, after we all go home. You got to sit there in your neighborhood and digest this day after day. How does community members like you, how does it affect you? It's got to be perplexing.
It's nerve-wracking, and it can be annoying. At the same time, it grips a community and places fear. What mm-hmm. crime does is find a community and grips it and holds it hostage to the point that people are in their homes afraid of getting shot, afraid of dying. Believe it or not, people want to live, even though we have X amount of time on Earth that we would then leave Earth. But most people are saying, wow, because the bullet has no name and it has right. no particular area that it wants to go. And so if a person is coming in and it doesn't hit its target that it wants, you have rapid gunfire that's coming through the wall, coming through your windows, if you're driving, coming there. So majority of the people are just afraid. And so to be afraid is not the answer, because you have to involve yourself. But now they don't want to. They probably seen the activity, but they don't want to report it because they're afraid of retaliation.
You know, too, death, and a lot of the young people don't realize, the people who are committing these crimes don't realize that death is final. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
You don't get, you know, at least, you know, some philosophies and religions believe in reincarnation. But as of right now, this is the only life we have. Right. But beyond that, people who are injured, people, you don't even need to, sometimes it impacts you knowing that there was a shooting in the neighborhood a couple of blocks down, half a mile away. It impacts you like, wow, you know, you get scared. People who have to deal with the injuries involved
when
in
it becomes a norm.
Right.
Majority of the time you, and with media and internet and different things like that, it's multiplied or it's then broadened and it's 3D right in your face. And so not only is it in your neighborhood, you see it across America. You see it Chicago, you see it Portage, you see it Valparaiso, whatever community is next to you, crime is there. And so just in the city of Gary, it just happens to be that they get all the attention. But majority mm-hmm. of the time, it's transits. Mm-hmm. There might be some locals. It may be someone who committed a crime in Lake Station or Portage or surrounding mm-hmm. areas
right.
and know that they can come into Gary and kind of go into the shadows mm-hmm. and get away with it, if no one comes and say anything. In most areas, law enforcement are so dedicated that they're roaming, and they have police presence within the local.
Right.
And so we then have to find a way to neutralize it locally. So you have outside law enforcement entities, the county, sheriff, the Indiana State Troopers, but when they come in, they leave. And so if the local law enforcement doesn't have anything in place mm-hmm. to fight it, and the community knows that, that makes them even more afraid.
Well, just recently, as you're well aware, Gary got a new mayor. Mayor Jerome Prince is the new mayor, just sworn in, took office January 1st, new police chief. He appointed Colonel Richard Ligon. But while the press and folks, regular folks, you know, see that as probably a new opportunity, the criminal element really probably don't care that there's a new transition, a sort of a new sheriff in town, so to speak, a new way, because there's been no drop off in the continued violence that we right. saw late into the year under Karen Freeman Wilson's administration into now. So what do you think might be causing all this? Some people have speculated, well, it's probably a gang war that's going on, that, you know, rival gangs are, you know, tit for tat going after each other. Does it even matter what the motivation is for this violence? It's just the violence is happening.
I think so. When you mention administration, you have an outgoing administration that tried to do the best they could with what they had. You had a prior administration from then tried to do the same thing. This administration, I would consider the newly appointed mayor, I would consider him to be a gentleman.
Sure.
When you think of politics, as of Roosevelt Allen was a gentleman, I don't see anything from following his career, even as an assessor, he was a gentleman. And
sure.
so to come into City Hall, you would say the same thing, but it's going to take, he's not going to be able to change things overnight. And each administration brings in their cabinet, or their leaders, department heads. He's in now, and crime has peaked. I think the data was showing that it hadn't been that high in 1983. It was something to that point, but the beginning of the year. And so the beginning of the year, you have unresolved murders, which you have your naysayers, and you have your optimistic people who rallied with him to get him in office. And so they're going to be always on a place of saying change can come. You have those that probably did not back him. They're looking for missteps. The community as a whole, you can't wait on government to bring change. Government brings laws and legislation.
Mm-hmm.
The community has to come from behind the walls, stop peeping through the window and calling someone on the telephone and explaining to them what can take place and what can happen and get involved. That means if you see a crime, call 911. Mm-hmm. If you have information on a crime, call your local law enforcement agency. The community has to help.
You know, we've seen where, okay, we do know communities, particularly communities of color, you know, they can be intimidated by gangs or people doing the shooting. But we've seen where not saying anything isn't a solution. It's actually making it worse. When they see, if you're not reporting it to the police, they're not coming out to respond because they don't know they're needed.
Correct.
So not saying anything, I haven't been in that position. So I know it must be
difficult. when you're dealing with a community of color, the first point of view comes racism. Mm-hmm. And so, excuse the expression, but the black community has a policy, you can't trust the white man. Mm-hmm. But then I think it was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. who stated that white on white supremacy is bad. But you know what's worse? Black on black. And so you can point a finger. We can have a discussion on racism. We can discuss Donald Trump. But I don't see Donald Trump in the black community pulling the trigger. I don't see him going through the window, taking the bars off the going in after the people have left to go to work to commit a crime. And so in the black community, the black community going to have to be held accountable for manning its own community. That's somebody's child. That's somebody's son. That's somebody's nephew. That's somebody's daughter. The people who are doing it in the community, some way or another, they are related to them, are a friend. And so you took discipline out, but we still have to raise our children. It used to be a time when somebody committed a crime. If you knew them, you went and got them and took them to the police department yourself. And so the uncles, cousins, the god brothers, the god sisters, they're going to have to take some type of accountability to say that how can we reach them? The religious community mm-hmm. going to have to do a better, going to have to respond a little bit more. I remember when the Mayor Karen was in office, mm-hmm. she put out a plea for the religious community. At that time, crime had peaked in. If you had a church, if you can come and stand on your corner mm-hmm. when the children are released from school for about 30 minutes, they had an uproar. It wasn't in their contract. Yeah. This is not what we are supposed to do. One gentleman I respect that came out, and that was Pastor Garner mm-hmm. at Trinity on, I believe, 19th in Virginia. He stood on 21st in Virginia. And so the religious community going to have to majority of these people come into your church.
Well, before the show started, you did reach out to Mayor Jerome Prince about possibly coming on the show or a spokesperson. They declined, but they did send a statement in that this is from Jerome Prince, mayor of Gary. People like Apostle East and community groups who look after are hugely important to moving Gary forward. Part of my call to reimagining Gary is to work with anyone who truly wants to help our community. That's from Mayor Jerome Prince. So we only got a couple of minutes left mm-hmm. in this segment. What can this new mayor or what can the governor of Indiana or President Trump do to aid communities like Gary who are suffering through so much violence and have been suffering for years?
Yeah, first of all, you have to take care of your first responders. Your law enforcement officer, you have to make sure that they want to go home, but they also want to live as well. And when I say live, compensate them if I'm not mistaken, going off the air, Gary is the lowest paid for law enforcement in the surrounding area. And so there are some good people in the law enforcement that are out here every day. I'm thankful for my interaction with law enforcement for the things that I've done. They have come to make sure I was okay. And so we just need to make sure that we're able to take care of them and their families, as well as we're able to take care of others' family, and then work with people that are out here with boots on the ground in the trenches and supply them with some funding. I come and just help them. And we all can come to the table and find a solution.
Well, Apostle East is a community activist in Gary, Indiana. Apostle East, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you.
Michael Puente talking with Gary Resden, an activist, Apostle East, Off Mic. Again, can be heard here on Lakeshore Public Radio every Friday morning at 11 o'clock. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson spent some time last year in South Texas. And while she was there, she talked with a local who gave her some insight into how some things in that area had changed. And she also gives her own account of some changes in a small Texas town. Here's that report.
My family is directly across this river. My Mexican family is directly across. There is a lot of violence on the other side of our river. Very bad violence going on, but it's a drug fight. It's a territory fight for drugs. But that's on that side of the river.
Crossing the border into the United States from Mexico has gotten more complicated over the last several years. There's the more stringent government regulations and increased focus on border protection and security that makes it more complex. There's also the terrible violence on the Mexico side of the Rio Grande River. Lakeshore Public Radio traveled to the southern part of Texas and talked to the locals who say that wasn't always the case. Nelly Garcia, who is a Rio Grande Valley native from Palmview, Texas, said traversing between the U.S. and Mexico border used to be no big deal and life wasn't always violent along the river.
Back in the day during Easter, we used to go to Anza Luas, as a matter of fact, where now they have a bridge. Back then, they didn't have an international bridge. It's fairly new. And we used to go to the Anza Luas Park, and we had land close to, right on the river. And we used to get on our jet skis. It used to be very safe. We had family that was from Cavazos that they were on the other side of the river. So we would meet in the middle of the river on boats and in the jet skis, and everything was peaceful. It was, nothing was like, oh, there's border patrols, there's this or that. And nobody would even think about crossing and staying or not coming or whatever. It was just Easter Sunday. And now we would even party there at Pepe's on the river. I mean, up until I was later on in high school and my early teens and late teens, we used to always celebrate Easter there and have a really good time all through high school. But we're no longer allowed to be near the water. I do cross the bridge walking back and forth, mm-hmm. but it's not, the danger's not close on the bridge, but it's all along the river.
What do you think's changed?
The war in Mexico. The drug war, yes. And it's really the territory. The Zetas are trying to be in the border and the cartels are there, and it's just really a way of living for our families in Mexico. I mean, you cross the border and there's, you know, chopped heads at the plaza, you know, like it's just awful. The way it is, and you just go around it, really.
You see them? You see the chopped heads?
I seen the chopped heads. It just happened. It just happened like a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. It just happened a couple of weeks ago. And it's a mess. It's a mess with the cops over there and with the Zetas and with all that kind of stuff. So
what are Zetas?
It's a gang. The Z.
Okay.
It's Z in Spanish.
How long has this been going on?
I don't know. Very long time. I stopped going to Mexico when my son was born. I got to take him one time to the border. Well, not to the border, to a baseball game. We grew up over there, but he was born in 2007. And that's when we started seeing it wasn't safe anymore. Yeah. 2007. I mean, to me, in me, it's 2007. You see a lot of people that they go and come and it's nothing to them. But I don't take my kids. Like, you know, very rare. I'll take him to Progreso. I don't take him to Reynosa or Miguel Alemán. Mm-hmm.
The U.S. government implemented regulations that required passports for air and sea travel to and from Canada, Mexico, Central and South America, the Caribbean, and Bermuda. That law went into effect on January 8, 2007. Before the law, U.S. citizens only had to show a driver's license and birth certificate to travel in the Western Hemisphere. And since President Trump took office in January of 2017, there's the hyper-focus on more stringent immigration policies and tightened border control. Getting back into the United States from Mexico is not as easy as it used to be. Garcia tells us about an experience she had.
It was in the Anza Luas Bridge, crossing to Reynosa. We were going to the hospital because a friend of mine had a weight loss surgery over there in Reynosa at the Muguerza Hospital, which is right under the Anza Luas Bridge on the Mexico side. So on our way back, it was my friend from Houston, her friend that I didn't know, and myself crossing. We were going in my car. We get to the hospital. Everything was nice and dandy. Visit, driving back. And when we got to the bridge, they took us in for inspection, not knowing what it was about. And it was about our passports. I'm from the Valley. My friend is from Houston. And her friend is born in Colombia. So they automatically make, all kinds of ideas of what the relationship was between the countries. Like me being from the border, her being from Colombia, her being from Houston. They were just thinking, like, they raided our whole car thinking that we were, I don't know, crossing drugs or something. Like, it just seemed that way. Mm-hmm. You know, like we were doing something illegal, which we weren't. But we're just friends.
The heightened border control has even changed the landscape of and around a historical landmark in the small Texas town of Los Ebenos. Los Ebenos is home to the last pull ferry in the United States. I first visited the Los Ebenos Pull Ferry in 2006. It was this quaint little area on the Rio Grande River. It had trees all around, and the area looked very untouched. It still pretty much looks like that, but now there's also this very large Border Patrol station on site right next to the Pull Ferry. When I first visited in 2006, the Border Patrol station was not there, but there was a couple of small shops that appeared to be good businesses. The store I went into, called Los Ebenos Ferry Junction, sold t-shirts, hats, refrigerator magnets, ice cream, and snow cones. It also had painted terracotta figurines galore. I bought a painted terracotta fish with an open mouth that I still use at my kitchen sink to hold the sponge. When I went back to the Pull Ferry in March of 2019, things had changed. There was the constructed Border Patrol station, and the Los Ebenos Ferry Junction store was closed down, and the store next to it was also shut down, and there were also several abandoned houses in the area. It looked a little bit like a ghost town. It appeared as if the increased Border Patrol presence, combined with all the violence in Mexico over the drug war, had taken its toll. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
Many Hoosier farmers want more health care options, and on Wednesday they got closer to that goal. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports a bill allowing the State Farm Bureau to offer a group health plan is moving forward.
At a Senate committee hearing Wednesday, Hoosier farmers said they have trouble getting affordable health insurance. Some have taken jobs off the farm to get insurance, and others go without coverage. Lacey Scheller says her family's turned to a religious health sharing plan, but they find it limiting.
Payment is 100% at their discretion. They say they cover everything as long as it's an act of God and not a result of living an ungodly life. So, define that. I can't.
Scheller says her and her husband would prefer another health care option from the Farm Bureau. Some committee members raised concerns about the impact on the current health insurance marketplace. They were also concerned that some people might be denied coverage, but they passed the bill 8-0. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
And after proposing more than 100 education bills, lawmakers in Indianapolis are facing a key legislative deadline next week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay says that there are some education bills that have progressed through the House chamber.
In the session's first half, House lawmakers only approved about a dozen education-focused bills. They cover things like the impact of the state's new iLearn test, school flexibility, and moving teacher evaluations away from test scores. Representative Dale Devon filed a bill to increase teachers' awareness and response to student trauma. He says teacher prep programs should include it in their curriculum.
Just to be clear, this is not anything new on teachers. It's a teacher preparation.
Another approved House bill would boost state efforts to provide more education to special needs students who left high school without a diploma. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
The state of Indiana and Porter County health officials are waiting to find out more about a person who is potentially infected by the coronavirus to find out if they indeed have the virus. Porter County Health Department Administrator Letty Zapata says that the individual has been isolated and is recovering and no longer has a fever. And she says that medical tests have been sent to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
The person was tested and those tests have been sent to ISDH. ISDH, in turn, has to send them to CDC. They're the ones that actually do the analysis. We are waiting for the results. The results can take anywhere from 24 to 36 hours.
Letty says that one of the most difficult aspects about identifying for the coronavirus is that the symptoms are close to those of the flu. But she says people can protect themselves anyway by following some simple hygiene tips, like washing your hands, by covering your mouth if you cough or sneeze, and by sanitizing surfaces. And on the subject of coronavirus, concern about the coronavirus is also causing gasoline prices to drop here in Indiana and many other states.
With the coronavirus stopping transportation in much of China, and China being the world's second largest oil consumer, that's causing a hit to petroleum.
When you have a tendency to see these, kind of fear-inducing events, people stay home and they consume less petroleum in the process, and that's the hit on oil and thus gas prices.
Head of petroleum analysis for Gas Buddy, Patrick DeHaan, says many stations across Indiana should start seeing prices get below $2 a gallon soon. John Herrick, Network Indiana.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. And also our thanks to Tim Maloney with the Hoosier Environmental Council, to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson, to Gary Dick from Inside Indiana Business and his guests on this segment, and off-mic host Michael Puente. Hope you can join us on Monday. We'll have a conversation with another person who is interested in taking Congressman Pete Fisklosky's seat in Washington. That's more coming up on Regionally Speaking.